is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Dan Hurley. Later in the program, we'll talk about a plan to reduce panhandling in Cincinnati and update you on the new and improved Reds. But first, we'll focus on news out of Kentucky. Joining me to sort through the past couple of weeks, our Associated Press Frankfurt correspondent Adam Beam, Lexington Herald Leader political reporter Daniel DeRocher, and editor and publisher of River City News, Michael Monks. You can join the conversation by emailing talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Hello, and I'm going to have everybody sign in as I say hello so we recognize everybody's voices. Adam, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Michael.
So great to be here. Thanks.
All right. So there are so many places to start, but I think we're going to start with the governor's race in Kentucky. The Attorney General, Andy Beshear, has decided to run. And Adam, was that a surprise?
No, it was the worst-kept secret in Kentucky politics. I mean, this is a guy who, I think ever since he was elected as Attorney General, has been, you know, positioning himself to run for governor. You know, he has sued the Republican governor, Matt Bevin, I think seven or eight times. It's hard to keep track of all the disagreements that they've had. And, you know, has really been critical of him. And of course, Matt Bevin has returned those comments and called Andy Beshear incompetent, said he's like the worst attorney general in the country. So they've really been at odds with each other since the beginning. And, you know, really, I think in earnest, Andy Beshear's kind of groundwork for this governor campaign for governor started last year at Fancy Farm, which is the big political picnic that that all the candidates have to go to. And he went there, and for the first time, he really sounded like a candidate. He was really contrasting himself with Governor Bevin. And so really since last August, it's just been a matter of not if, but when.
Daniel, one of the things that's interesting about this, though, is, as Adam mentioned, he's certainly going out and talking against Governor Bevin. But Governor Bevin hasn't said if he's going to run for re-election. Is that correct?
Yeah. The governor has not formally declared whether or not he's going to run for re-election. Just in talking to Republicans, they seem pretty confident that he will run for re-election, and they say that nobody's really positioning themselves to technically either get into a primary or to run should he not run on the Republican side. And I think it's also worth pointing out, Adam talks about those lawsuits, and the biggest lawsuit that he's involved in right now, and the one that he's going to be harping on the campaign trail, is the pension lawsuit. And we can see that in who he chose as his running mate for Lieutenant Governor, Jacqueline Coleman. She's an assistant principal at Nelson County High School. And also in just kind of his language and rhetoric and what he's done over the past few months, right? Like, part of his announcement tour was at Pike County High School in Eastern Kentucky. And the people in Eastern Kentucky, where the schools are a major employer, where there's a lot of public employees, they were really, really upset with what the Republicans were trying to do in reforming the pension bill. And so he's going to try and use that and try and campaign on some of that anger and some of that animosity towards Governor Bevin, because a lot of people felt insulted in the way that Governor Bevin talked to them over the course of that pension debate.
Let's talk, Michael, a little bit about the reaction in Northern Kentucky. Did anybody take much notice to the fact that Andy Beshear decided to run?
Well, the interesting thing about Northern Kentucky in this election cycle is that for the first time in really a generation, nearly every legislative seat is contested in partisan terms. You know, Northern Kentucky is dominated by the Republican Party and has been long before the rest of the state. I always say that Northern Kentucky is quite hipstery when it comes to their Republicanism, because they were Republicans before Republicans were cool. And it's interesting to note about Andy Beshear's specifically. He does come up here a lot. He does make sure to visit all the media when he's up here as well to get as much exposure as he can to touch Northern Kentucky voters. His father was governor just before Matt Bevin, immediately before, and served two terms. He ran against a couple of unpopular Republican candidates in both of his victories. But Steve Beshear won Kenton and Campbell counties, and that's a very difficult thing for a Democrat to do. It will be interesting to see if Beshear's overall popularity, if it hasn't been tarnished too much by the attacks from the current governor, last and boost Andy Beshear to victory next year should he win the nomination. Keep in mind, Andy Beshear only won the attorney general's race in 2015 by 2,000 votes, and a very good year for Republicans, largely on the name Beshear. Steve Beshear was a very popular governor leaving office. And as far as his role in Northern Kentucky, he did not win the same counties that his father did, but he did keep the races pretty close in both Kenton and Campbell counties. So he could be a formidable foe.
Adam, one of the issues that has come up in this race is the issue, I believe it's with Longmire. There's a scandal that's gone on. Someone from his father's administration who also worked for him and given money is in jail now. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's all about and what it may mean in the campaign?
Yes, Tim Longmire was a high-ranking state official in both Steve Beshear's administration and Andy Beshear's term as Attorney General. For Steve Beshear, Tim Longmire eventually became the Personnel Cabinet Secretary. And under Andy Beshear, he was the Deputy Attorney General, which is a constitutional office. It's the second highest ranking law enforcement officer in the state, behind only the Attorney General. And in both of those roles, Tim Longmire was accused and later convicted or pled guilty to taking bribes and kickbacks as relating to various state contracts. And he would take a lot of that money and funnel it to Democratic candidates and causes because he really valued being seen as like a big mover and shaker politically. And it was hard for him to keep up with the demand of making, you know, trying to raise all this money for political candidates. So he got a lot of this money illegally and gave it to the candidates that way. Now, while he was working for Andy Beshear and all this was happening, you know, he was donating a bunch of money to Andy Beshear's campaign. So he donated at least $2,000, and then various associates of Tim Longmire also donated. It believed to be up to more than $20,000 in suspect contributions to Andy Beshear's campaign. So now that he's running for governor, a lot of the Republicans are taking really scrutinizing this and saying, hey, you've got all this tainted money that was part of your previous campaign. And Andy has promised that he was going to give that money back. He's going to donate it to charity, to an open government kind of government watchdog group called Common Cause. But he hasn't done it yet. And the reason is because he says, you know, the state officials are still auditing my campaign account for 2015. I'm waiting until that audit is completed. But it's been, you know, 2.5 years since that campaign was over. The audit is still not complete. So as long as he has not returned that money, he's probably still going to be criticized by the governor and others for that.
Go ahead.
But when we asked him about it at the announcement, his response about the whole Longmire scandal was that it shows his transparency, and so he tried to kind of spin it into a transparency argument where he said that as soon as he heard about Longmire, he immediately made all the documents available for investigators. He hired a special prosecutor and that sort of thing. But I think that that's a hard kind of pivot for him to make because I think people see the scandal and it just kind of taints him overall. And so it'll be interesting to see if he can kind of get out from under the weight of those accusations.
Daniel, do you think that that we're going to see anybody else enter the race? There is talk about a possible another Democrat who was from the Steve Beshear administration.
I think we're certainly going to see a lot of other Democrats enter this race. I think it'll be kind of a big primary with a lot of big Democratic names looking. There's already been several mentioned, including House Minority Leader Rocky Adkins. He said that he's strongly considering the race. Current Secretary of State Allison Lundergan Grimes is said to be considering the race. Former Auditor Adam Eblin. One of those former Beshear staffers, his name's Coleman Eldridge. He's from Georgetown, Kentucky, which is down here in central Kentucky. And he was the executive assistant to Steve Beshear, and he's considering it. There's a Democratic representative from Louisville, Attica Scott, who she has also thrown her name into the ring. And so will all of them actually declare? Well, we don't really know. A lot of them are saying that they're waiting until after the legislative elections in 2018 before they make their decision. But I do think that Andy Beshear will not be alone in this primary, and he'll certainly have some tough competition in his attempts to win the Democratic nomination.
And I think that'll be a good thing for the Democratic Party in Kentucky. You know, so I moved to the state in 2014, and since I've been here, there's not been competition on the Democratic side for these major statewide races. They just had to kind of pick their nominee, and they all coalesce behind the nominee. And there's something to say about unity, but there's also something to say for having a robust primary because it kind of prepares the candidate for the general election. And I think the Democrats are starting to realize that, and so I think there's kind of a want and a desire among some party officials to have this kind of robust primary heading up to the governor's race. I think it might kind of get them battle-tested and ready to take on an incumbent.
You mentioned the pension situation and the lawsuit involved with that, and a judge this past week or 2 weeks ago rejected Governor Bevin's request to revisit the ruling in the pension case. Tell us what's going on with that.
Well, so Judge Philip Shepard, he ruled that the pension bill that was passed was unconstitutional, not because of anything that's in the pension bill itself, but for the way, the process that lawmakers used to pass it. And so the governor, he asked Judge Shepard to reconsider that ruling. And he didn't ask him to rule, you know, to change the ruling and say, oh, no, it is constitutional. He just asked him to make a decision based on the contents of the bill. Because they said, look, this case is going to go to the Supreme Court. We don't want the Supreme Court to just to decide this case narrowly on, you know, on the process that lawmakers use to pass it. We think that the Supreme Court should be able to decide this case on the contents of the bill, whether what's in the bill is constitutional. Because if they don't, then the legislature will just, you know, if it's a problem with process, the legislature can just come back in January and fix the process and pass it again. But if and then the Attorney General, whoever else in office at the time, might decide, well, we still think the contents are unconstitutional. We're going to have another lawsuit. And so the governor was asking him to kind of amend his ruling, but the judge declined. But it's still possible for the Supreme Court to still consider the ruling based on the contents of the bill, but they won't be, you know, required to.
And it's kind of interesting in terms of as a legal move, because one of the contents of that bill is the inviolable contract and whether or not the bill violates this contract made to public employees that they can't take away benefits from them. And the governor's attorneys had tried to get Philip Shepard removed from the case because he has a pension. And they'd be able to make the same argument for all of the Supreme Court justices as well. And so it's kind of interesting to also frame it in the way that they were maneuvering in the process to get their side of the argument or to get a win for their side of the argument.
Michael, what did you think this whole pension issue means in Northern Kentucky? Certainly, there were plenty of teachers that spent some time in Frankfort just when the pensions were being discussed.
Well, it's the single biggest reason, I believe, that you're seeing all these contested legislative races and really that you're seeing energy behind lesser-known Democratic candidates who are jumping in the field and gaining support early. We saw in the Republican primary in May when one of the leaders in the Republican House caucus lost in a primary, Jonathan Schell, was defeated. I think that's sending shivers through across the state, but particularly in Northern Kentucky, where Democrats are seeing an opportunity for the first time in a long time. That's an issue that they can hound their opposition on, because all of the Republicans in Northern Kentucky's legislative caucus, and that includes the entire legislative caucus except for two members, they're going to be hit really hard on this issue. And you can see a lot of teachers. We have a couple of educators who are in these races, and that's going to be a trend across the state. And I think here in Northern Kentucky, the Democrats are going to see whether they can get any energy. They may not be successful this time around. It's very, very difficult in Northern Kentucky, but it will be interesting to see if they have anything that they can build upon in the future based solely on that pension issue.
We're talking about all the news in Kentucky this week, and my guest, Associated Press Frankfort correspondent Adam Beam, Lexington Herald leader political reporter Daniel DeRocher, and editor and publisher of River City News, Michael Monks. If you want to join the conversation, we can't take your calls today because of some technical issues, but we are available on Facebook and Twitter or by email. You can email your questions talk@wvxu.org or post them on those social media sites. We did just get word that this has happened, and both Adam and Daniel, you were talking about this earlier. There's a situation with the Papa John Pizza founder and a stadium named for him, No More. Tell us what's happening.
Well, John Schnatter is the founder, president of Papa John's Pizza, and you know it's kind of unusual in that his face and his persona is directly tied to that company. I mean, everybody knows he's in all commercials, and he's in the logo. And the name of the University of Louisville football stadium is Papa John's Cardinal Stadium. Well, of course, Papa John got in some trouble early this week when word came out that he used a racial slur while on a conference call. And, sponsors and, customers and people have quickly been distancing themselves from them. And it just came out today that the University of Louisville has decided to strip his name from the stadium. So it's no longer going to be called Papa John's Cardinal Stadium. It's just going to be called simply Cardinal Stadium.
Wanted to get that out there. Just that's big news happening today. In fact, in just the past few hours, I think the official word came out on that. Want to go back to the to the governor, Governor Bevin, and a judge this week also blocked some Medicaid work requirements the Bevin administration had put into place. And in return, the governor cut dental and vision coverage for a lot of people. Was this a surprise, and what does it really mean to people in terms of dental and vision coverage, Adam?
I don't think the governor's response, his reaction of cutting the dental and vision benefits, was a surprise, because he and his administration have said that they would do this if they got an adverse ruling in the lawsuit. So just to back up a little bit, Kentucky was the first state in the country to get permission to require some Medicaid recipients to either have a job or to volunteer for community service or go to school or go to a job training course, do some type of work in order to keep their benefits. And those new rules were supposed to go into effect on July 1st, but a judge in Washington, D.C. ruled just the Friday before it was supposed to happen and blocked it, said it's illegal, you can't do it. And so, you know, the Bevin administration said, look, we've been preparing for a year and a half to get these rules in place. And we had put, infrastructure, both technical and otherwise, in place in order to start rolling out these rules. And one of the rules was, look, if you want your dental and vision benefits, you're going to have to get them through doing other stuff. Like, they call it a rewards program. So it's kind of, you know, like if you go to the grocery store and you swipe your card and you get points, and after so many points you get, like, free gas or something. They wanted to do that for the Medicaid population. If you work, go to various classes, do these various good community-building things, we'll give you credit for that. And you can use those credits and exchange them for dental and vision benefits. And because the judge had struck down the whole thing, Governor Bevin said, well, I have no choice. We have to just strip it all because we don't have anything in place to provide. We have no mechanism to provide dental and vision benefits to this Medicaid population. Now, critics of that say this is just a farce. You know, he's just using this as an excuse to take health care away from some of the state's most vulnerable people. But the governor says his hands are tied, and he's promised to try to come to a quick resolution to this, whatever that means. We know he's going to appeal the judge's ruling, but whether they can come to some agreement in the short term that would restore some of these benefits is to be seen.
Adam, what about in terms of what's happening right now? I've heard there are people that are at these clinics. The clinics don't know who to charge. The people don't know if they can actually go for their appointments. What's the status of the situation right now for people looking for that care?
Well, it's just this mass chaos and confusion, because anytime you have a major event like this in some type of, you know, big, large bureaucracy, there's going to be questions. There's going to be confusion. There have been reports of children who, you know, were not supposed to be impacted by this at all, but of losing their benefits because of the way it was showing up in a computer. And, you know, basically the judge's ruling came down on a Friday. The decision to stop giving those benefits was made, I think, the next day on a Saturday. And so, you know, on Monday, these clinics and, you know, dentist offices and vision benefit places were trying to figure out what exactly it means for them, and they had little information. And so I think some of that's going to get sorted out. But in the short term, yeah, it's been lots of confusion. People showing up for their appointments have been very concerned to learn that they no longer have coverage.
Michael?
And there's some very important Northern Kentucky connections to all of this as well, because the new cabinet secretary that is overseeing a lot of this is Adam Meyer, and he's a Northern Kentucky guy. He was served on the Fort Thomas City Council until Governor Bevin was elected, and he became the deputy chief of staff. And just a couple of months before all these changes were announced, he took over this new secretary's role. And this is one of the largest employers in the government. So it's a very important role. And in fact, the new Kentucky Health Program was rolling out in the Northern Kentucky County. So they've had some meetings already, some public meetings in Covington for Campbell County, which was going to be the first county to see some of these changes. And then Kenton County was supposed to be next, and then Boone County after that. So all of this was to be tried in Adam Meyer's home district. And now there's just nothing left but confusion. And it's important to note, heading into an election year, I mean, this is, of course, an election year as well for the state house, but next year's statewide constitutional office holder elections, you have a Beshear back on the ballot. And the last Beshear who was in office gave Kentucky the expanded Medicaid. He was the one that created what was viewed as a model for the nation. And Kentucky is not known as a very healthy state, but that was a program that was very popular and has now been virtually dismantled. So adding Medicaid reform and pension crisis to the campaign trail this year in 2018, those are going to be some very significant issues for the Republicans to punch back against. I think they're going to have their hands full.
Daniel, anything from you on this?
Well, I was just going to say that one of my colleagues down in Pike County, he went and interviewed a dentist who receives Medicaid patients, and her calendar had 5.5 hours of vacancies, and usually she's seeing 3 patients an hour. So there, it's definitely affecting not only patients, but it's also affecting dentists in some of these rural areas.
Daniel, you worked on a story that resulted in an audit of the court and justice system in Kentucky that came out this week. Tell us what your story was about and what happened this week.
Yeah, so I had received a tip that there was something weird going on with surplus vehicle sales in the administrative branch of the Kentucky court system, where they were holding these employee-only sales for surplus products and selling products at a really discounted rate. And so when I started asking questions about it, it turned out that the Attorney General's office was also asking the same questions about it. And they instantly locked it down and said, there's an investigation going on, we're looking into this. And kind of stopped answering my questions. And so I was able to get the documents that showed how much they were selling the vehicles for, and the fact that, like, in one case, somebody purchased a vehicle for around $1,000, and then 2 years later, a car dealership in Lexington resold that exact same vehicle for $4,500. So they were clearly getting discounts on these vehicles. And in that process, the court system decided to stop doing surplus sales. They decided to adopt an open records policy, and they called for an audit. And finally, 13 months after they called for that audit, it was released. And this audit kind of confirmed a lot of what had already been reported, but also unveiled a lot of new and interesting information, particularly in relation to a sitting Supreme Court justice who rented rented office space from his 2 sons. And he rented that office space at 3 times higher than the next highest bid. That was put in to lease this office space. And so there's just all these kinds of questions about the oversight and the policy setting and ethical rules for the administrative office of the courts that are causing people to start saying, hey, what are you doing with these policies? And there need to be some changes that are made.
So what do you think is going to happen next?
They accepted some of the recommendations from the audit in terms of saying, yeah, we need to get a better grip on how we're setting our policies. But they also rejected quite a few of the recommendations. In particular, they said that they don't think that they have a responsibility to hold elected officials accountable, that the elected officials are ultimately held accountable by voters. And they kind of rejected the suggestions that there should be an independent ethics commission that overlooks not only just the judges, but also some of the administrators and executives in the court system.
So the short answer is not much will probably happen.
Truly, you think nothing at all?
Well, I mean, I think they've already done what they're going to do. They've already said, you know, they've gotten rid of some of an employee that they said was part of the problem. They made some changes to their policies, all of which they enumerated in their response to the audit yesterday. And beyond that, I mean, as Daniel just laid out, I don't think they have any plans to respond or to adopt any of those other recommendations.
Another piece of news, we talked about the situation with Papa John, but Michael, you have some news. You were writing just as you walked in the door. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, as I was coming up the steps, we got some breaking news that Dan Tuberke is stepping down as the head of TRIAD. That's the Tri-County Economic Development Corporation, a very important government entity that supports economic development in all 3 Northern Kentucky counties. It's overseen by the 3 judges executives from each of the counties. It's sort of like Ready Cincinnati for your Cincinnati listeners. I don't think it's a household name, even though it is critically important. It's funded by the car tax out at the airport. And Dan Tuberke has been there for 28 years, and he's stepping down. It's a very powerful position.
He was the
position.
Only person ever in that position, but wasn't he the
Absolutely.
First one this when is, the organization started?
It's an organization that's been around for fewer than 3 decades, right at about 3 decades, and he's led it the entire time. And this is the organization that a lot of the large industrial groups will reach out to first when they're scouting locations. So when you see a lot of the large manufacturing firms, the Amazons of the world, really landing in Boone County, this is the organization that is the touchstone. You know, Northern Kentucky is a loose collection of villages, and they don't have a direct leader, a strong mayor, a one-judge executive to call. So this organization was formed to address that issue. So a very powerful position just opened up in Northern Kentucky with Dan Tuberke stepping down. He just says he's going to pursue other opportunities.
So no specific. Did you know this was coming?
I mean, no, this really surprised me. That's why I started to write it while I was sitting here, because it was so surprising and it is very important. So I want to get that out, but really caught off guard by it.
Let's talk about a bunch of new rules, new laws that are going into effect in Kentucky. And all of you can weigh in on this. Michael, do you want to go over a couple of them?
Yeah, the Legislative Research Commission is a very good organization out of Frankfurt that publishes very good recaps of a lot of the committee meetings that take place during the sessions and in between the sessions. And they put out a good comprehensive list of some of the more important ones. Of course, the most important one that people are noticing is the new sales tax, the way that it's affecting items that they purchase that maybe they didn't before. Veterinarian services is one I've seen a lot circulating on Facebook, and I know I've mentioned issues that are going to be brought up on the campaign trail, but this is one that State Representative Dennis Keene, a Democrat, one of the two Democrats in the Northern Kentucky Legislative Caucus, he's sharing a lot of these stories from his constituents who are emailing him or Facebook messaging him about, I cannot believe that this price has gone up on the service for my vehicle or for the price to take care of my dog. So it's another feather in the campaign caps for Democrats, because they're going to be hitting them hard on this. Some of the other ones include some issues that some people might laugh at, even though they may be serious to others. And that includes Senate Bill 57, which will now allow a person who was injured by an act of terrorism to file a claim for damages against the terrorist in state court. And then there are some other more important ones, like House Bill 373, that will exempt some police body camera footage from being publicly released if it shows the interior of private homes, medical facilities, women's shelters, and jails, or if it shows a dead body. So, you know, police camera footage is a very hot topic with a lot of the murdering, the killing of unarmed black men. With this ruling, this could prove to be quite controversial, especially from our perspective as journalists.
Adam, anything you want to bring up that's going into effect tomorrow?
Well, I think that the biggest changes have already been in effect, and that has to do with the new taxes. The new tax laws went into effect, I believe, July 1st, and you know they impose a new 6% sales tax on a variety of services that previously had never been taxed. So that includes veterinarian services. You take your dog or your cat to the vet, you're going to have to pay 6% sales tax on that. And probably the biggest one is on auto repair. You know, if you go get your car fixed, you have to pay the sales tax on the parts, but the labor has been tax-free. Well, now you got to pay 6% on the labor as well. So I think people are going to be surprised, you know, after July 1st, who haven't been following this, when they go, you know, they got to get their car fixed, and then the bill, they see this extra 6% charge on the labor. And of course, you know, the tax increases were part of a larger package that's meant to increase funding to the state so they can pay for things like public education. And there's also a tax cut included in that, so a lot of people are going to see some, you know, we'll have to pay less on their income taxes. But overall, the tax increases, you know, outweigh the tax cuts. So it's a net gain for the state.
Thank you all for being here. We're about out of time. Covered a lot of ground in a short period of time. We appreciate you being here very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, thank you.
We've been talking about what's been happening in Kentucky. My guest, Press Frankfurt correspondent Adam Beam, Lexington Herald leader, political reporter Daniel DeRocher, and editor and publisher of River City News, Michael Monks. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our weekly news review. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about the Reds and how the team has changed from April to July. But first, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, emailing talk at WVXU.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Chris, glad to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be here, Marianne.
You're a regular guest, so we're always happy to see you come by. Let's start out talking about Councilman Jeff Pastor, and you wrote about his campaign finance reports and what is and is not happening. There have been a number of questions. Give us a little background and what's happening now.
Yeah, so Councilman Pastor has had some issues with his campaign finance filings. You know, when he originally filed them, back after the election, there was a lot of details missing that you kind of have to put in there, including how you spent your money. You raised money for a campaign. You have to tell everybody who you got it from, and then you have to tell them how you spent it. And initially, he only offered kind of a credit card receipt. And so, you know, you didn't know which vendors he had paid and whatnot. So he filed a new report late last week that kind of outlined some of that information, you know, most of the information. So we got to see that for the first time. There was also a question as to, in his report in the fall, right before the election, he had reported that he had loaned himself a little bit of more than $50,000 for his campaign, which, you know, gets a lot of attention when you write yourself a check or your campaign a check for that much money. And in this amended report that he filed late last week, he decided that that wasn't actually a loan and that he and his wife had spent that money as an in-kind contribution is what it's called, where you just pay for certain things out of your pocket. And in this case, he said that he paid for some advertising and other services. He wasn't real specific about that, so we're not kind of clear whether he's going to need to file another.
I'm going to say, is that legal? Are you allowed to do in-kind contributions?
You are, but usually you have to say, you know, usually it's like a restaurant provides, you know, $3,000 in meals for a campaign staff event or something like that. That's usually the nature of that. You don't usually see a lot of candidates filing in-kind contributions. So that was an interesting change in his report, and we're not, I think, completely clear on what it means and whether that filing that he made is complete enough. That's something that the Board of Elections will have to decide, and we'll see if they do that.
So you're just waiting.
We're waiting, but
is there a deadline?
I don't know if there's a new deadline. It depends on whether the board feels that is a complete, and the staff members at the board will also review it. It will depend on whether they believe that's a complete filing, basically. And so he's been given extensions in the past. The board is very lenient in terms of they want you to comply and they want to give you a reasonable amount of time to comply. But after a while, I think they probably get a little impatient. The other thing that's notable here is, you know, is that never mind. We can move on from that.
All right, if you're sure. What about some plans came out this week about efforts to reduce homelessness? You reported that there have been some issues with aggressive panhandling.
Right. You know, over as the opioid crisis here has gotten pretty bad in the last couple of years, we've seen a lot more aggressive panhandling in downtown over the Rhine, the city's basin neighborhoods in particular. And what happened was 3CDC kind of formed a working group of social service agencies and other downtown organizations like Downtown Cincinnati Incorporated, and they looked at ways to try to deal with that problem. And what they came up with is a plan in which the main thrust of it or the main feature of it is that City Gospel Mission will have a jobs van that goes around to random sites throughout downtown and OTR. And they will basically offer people who are panhandling a job for the day. And typically what the job is to go beautify the city, clean up the litter that's around. And it pays $9 an hour. And it's about, I think it's a 6 or 7 hour a day job. And they have met some pretty good success in the first week, they reported. Over more than 80% of the people that they offered a job to decided to take them up on that. So they consider that to be pretty successful. They're also adding some case management workers who will go out and meet with people and try to understand their situation and try to connect them with services. So it's a pretty comprehensive plan in addition to the parking meters that they've repurposed to allow people, instead of giving a panhandler money, you can put money into the meters and that money would go to help serve those people.
Now, you mentioned that about 80% of the people they offer jobs to accepted, but how many people do they even have the opportunity to offer jobs to?
So it's only 10 per day, and I think that's kind of a starting number. I think they're going to assess the results of the program, and you know, if they need to add more, I think they're going to try to do that. But the initial budget for the whole thing is about $250,000 a year.
So if you're talking about, you said 10 people a day, that's just a very small percentage of the number of homeless people in the city, correct?
Right, right. And it's not so much aimed at the wider homeless population. It's aimed at people that they find on the street panhandling. And I'm sure that it's more than 10 per day. But, you know, typically around Fountain Square, you see kind of the same group of 3 or 4 people. They'll be holding up a sign. Some of them don't typically approach you, but they'll, you know, look you in the eye and, you know, try to gain your attention and hope that you contribute. So those are the types of people they'll be going up to. They won't be going to like a homeless shelter and saying, hey, who wants a job today? It'll be primarily aimed at the panhandling population. So it's very focused.
Has there been any talk about whether they earn more money panhandling versus how much money they earn at $9 an hour?
According to what City Gospel Mission told me, they earn about $9 an hour. So that's more than the $20 an hour that they have been told by the panhandlers that they earn in a typical day. That's, you know, some are going to earn more, some are going to earn less doing panhandling.
They earn $20 an hour panhandling?
I'm sorry, $20 a day panhandling,
okay.
My bad.
Just making sure there.
No,
okay.
It'd be pretty good, right? $20 a day is way less than $9 an hour, so.
Has this program worked in any other cities? Is there any comparisons?
Yeah, they've looked at peer cities, and the ones that stick out in my head, I believe, are Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there was one other city that slipped my mind. But Lexington was what it was, and that's kind of where they got the idea, and they feel that the success rate there was such that it was something worth trying here in Cincinnati.
Do they try out different people, or is it always can the same person get picked up day after day?
You know, their goal is to do this randomly. So if they go to a site and the guy that was there yesterday wants to do it again, that's fine. But they don't. City Gospel told me that they don't necessarily want a situation where people are like trying to find the jobs van every day. What they would rather have those people do is if they're interested in getting back on their feet. They want to connect them with the services that we have available in the city, whether it's job training or housing or whatever it is. They want to connect them to those services and hopefully get them off the street and not panhandling anymore.
And that's the sort of thing that they are offering with the people that they do pick up, as they connect them with some of those services then?
Right. They offer it. And one of the questions, you know, a lot of people, you know, not a lot of people, but some people who live on the street, that's a choice that they've made. And they're not interested in the regulations that sometimes come with social service agencies or homeless shelters or whatever. So it's not an attempt to force them into it, but they definitely do want to make them available to those folks. And the success rate on that, I think, was not as great. I think in the first week, they only had two or three people say, yes, I want to have these services.
So city council's on break.
Yeah.
Does that mean you get
God.
To just chill? Or?
No, you know, we have a lot of things left over from the budget. And, you know, I think as you guys were talking about yesterday, there's a parking plan that two parking plans really that are starting to germinate over there. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about those in the next couple of weeks. And then we had an interesting story yesterday in politics, AFTAB Pierval pledging not to support Nancy Pelosi if he is elected over Steve Chabot this fall. So had a column about that this morning, and so we have all that stuff to deal with this summer.
Council comes back in session in August.
That's right. Yes.
And other than parking, what else do you think they'll be talking about? They only have one meeting in August.
They have one meeting. It's either July 31st or August 1st. I think they'll start to talk about that parking issue. Usually what happens, I think, is in the summer break, there's some development deals that at least this is something that I'll watch for, some development deals that may be percolating over in the Department of Community and Economic Development. And they may bring those to a vote. They may bring those to a hearing. I do know one of the key things on their agenda is some charter amendments for this fall's election, including do they go back to two-year terms? Do they have staggered four-year terms? Those are two of the major questions that'll potentially be taken up later this month.
And there's been a lot of talk about P.G. Sittenfeld and
Chris Smitherman
and the whole who's texting who and what group. Is that – I guess you could probably briefly explain it better than me.
Yeah.
Is that going to turn into a big deal for the election?
You know, it's hard to tell. I mean, I don't think it'll be an issue in this year's election because neither of them are on the ballot. But, you know, just to give the listeners a little background, you know, there was during the city's political crisis over city manager Harry Black, the five Democrats – minus David Mann, he would be the sixth. They sent out a bunch of text messages about how they wanted to handle that situation, and they talked about drafting a press release.
As a group text
between the five of them. And so that's obviously a council majority. It's a quorum, and they got slapped on the knuckles for that because that obviously is kind of holding a meeting. And so Smitherman has sought to make great hay out of that. And what you saw a week ago was that some of Sittenfeld's political allies, and of course, you know, we're not clear if there's coordination or not there. They would tell you that there wasn't, but I don't think it's actually a coincidence. Some of Sittenfeld's political allies said, well, look, Chris Smitherman was in on a 9-person text in which he talked about policy that he thought should change, including the city's form of government, whether it should be strong mayor or city manager. And so he also is guilty of basically conducting city business behind closed doors. And of course, Smitherman takes great umbrage at that accusation. He said he was simply responding to a text from the city manager to all 9 council members, and that he feels the judge will toss out that argument because it's ridiculous.
We shall see where it goes when it comes to election time.
Yes, it's going to be a long 3.5 years.
Thank you so much for talking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Dan Hurley. The Reds started out the year with far more losses than wins, but over the past month or so, it seems like a new team with grand slams, come from behind wins, and a new manager. Joining me to talk about what's going on is senior baseball writer at The Athletic, C. Trent Rosecrans. C. Trent, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So the year started out not so good. They were losing and losing and losing. What the heck is happening now?
Well, you know, really it's all started with the starting. The starting pitching has been much better. Anthony DeSclafani has been back from his injury. They acquired Matt Harvey, who has been pretty good, and that's two of the five spots. The other three, we've seen the youngsters kind of go up and down. That's Sal Romano, Tyler Mahle, and Luis Castillo. But they have a good offense. They've had a good offense, and then the bullpen has been improved this offseason. And when those three things are working, you're going to win games.
Well, it seems like a lot of folks had lost hope that anything would happen. I mean, they were something like, what, 3-18 when they started.
Uh-huh.
But it is getting better. Joey Votto had a slow start. Is he picking up? I mean, is this normal for him?
Yeah, you know, he's done it the last couple of years where he's had a slow start and then he kind of gets into his rhythm. He's not hitting for as much power as he did last year, but he's still kind of this hitting savant who leads the league in on-base percentage. Eugenio Suarez is really taking a step forward. And then Scooter Gennett, a lot of people thought his second half last year was a little bit of a fluke, and it's proven to be anything but. So the offense has really been there, especially from those three guys who were coincidentally named to the All-Star team.
Well, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but first, they've also lately been playing some teams that are doing very well in each of their divisions. The Reds are still in last place, we should point out, despite all of their improving. But they seem to be able to play with some of these teams that are doing very well. Have they always had that ability to be able to stand up to that, or do you think that they've improved as the season has gone on?
I mean, they've improved. A lot of it has been the return of all these players. And just the nature of baseball, where the last place team beats the worst team in baseball can beat the best team in baseball, and it doesn't really cause a seismic shift. So, you know, I think they've kind of been in there. The schedule, it hasn't been one of those things where the schedule has been particularly favorable. Of course, it has helped that they're playing the American League Central and Interleague play this year, and I think they're 10-3 against the American League Central, which is by far the worst division in baseball.
Let's talk about the Indians. They had two very interesting games with the Indians. Of course, the first game, but the second and third games of the series are the ones that were interesting. So you had the Reds losing 4-0 in the ninth, and they come back and hit 7 runs in the ninth inning, which I think set a record going back a century or something like that. And then the next night, the Indians just pound the heck out of the Reds, 19-4, the Reds lose. How can those two teams be the same team?
Well, it always starts with the starting pitching. And the Reds got competent starting pitching from Sal Romano on the first day when Trevor Bauer, the Indian starter, was lights out. And the Indians' bullpen is a little shaky, and they took advantage of that. All the runs were scored with two outs in that ninth inning, which made it even more impressive. And then the next day, you know, Tyler Mahle wasn't pitching well, and then they had to go to their bullpen to some of their younger, less reliable pitchers, and it continued. And that's kind of the nature of baseball, as I was saying beforehand, that every day is different, and that's a big part of that is because of the starting pitching.
We talked about the Reds still being in last place, but as you mentioned, three All-Stars with Votto, Gennett, and Suarez. Is it very common to have a last-place team get that many players into the All-Star game?
I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not that surprising. So much of that is dependent on the position. And there's a couple of really good players at both second base and third base, but the Reds guys were doing well. And because, as I pointed out, really the biggest problem with the team during their start was starting pitching. It's not really that surprising to see that the offensive performances from the other players get rewarded like that.
What about players on the bench that are not everyday players as they come into the games? Is the bench deep this year at all?
Well, it's a little bit deeper in one way in that they have four outfielders that they are rotating as starters. So they have four outfielders that they all feel are starting type players. And that means that there's one starting caliber player on the bench at all times. And that has helped. And then kind of those other three spots have really been a mixture of people. And you've seen some young guys like Brandon Dixon, who's back at AAA now, and Alex Blandino, who have been called up and are new to the big leagues.
And as a pitcher, we found out the other night. Right?
Well, and that helps. There's a trend in baseball over the last couple of years to have more relief pitchers. And that's because starting pitching isn't as good. And so there are more relievers. With eight relievers, that leaves only four bench players. One of those has to be a catcher. The other is, in the Red situation, the other outfielder that feels a starter. That leaves two other spots. So when you have someone like Michael Lorenzen, who was an All-American outfielder in college, but also threw 100 miles an hour, so that in the professionals he concentrated on pitching, it makes him a little bit more valuable, and he can do a little bit more. And so it's been kind of a super sub type situation with Michael Lorenzen.
Well, we've also had pitchers that can hit grand slams. Now that's unusual, right?
Both Lorenzen, yes, and as a pinch hitter, which was quite interesting, as well as Anthony DeSclafani, who had one. I don't believe that Anthony DeSclafani would categorize himself as a power hitter or even much of a hitter, but, you know,
he got lucky.
One swing of the bat, things can happen.
Well, the All-Star break is not that far off, and everyone always takes a look at where things stand, and the Reds look like they will clearly still be in last place then. What do you think is going to happen after the break? Can they get any further up in the rankings?
I honestly, you know, there's a lot of teams between them and that second wild card spot. So it's very difficult to see them pushing towards playoff berth. But what I think you could see is continued development from some young pitchers and signs of hope. There's also the trade deadline at July 31st. So, you know, Matt Harvey will be traded. They traded for Matt Harvey so that they could trade Matt Harvey. That was pretty evident from the beginning. But then the question becomes, do you trade Scooter Jeanette or Raisel Iglesias, both players who would bring a much greater return? And that will say a lot about how close the front office thinks this team is to competing in 2019.
Well, they've called this the building year. How do you think Bob Castellini feels now? Have you talked to him at all?
I haven't talked to him recently, but I know this is a lot what he expected coming into this season. This is what he was hoping to see. And I think you're seeing a bit of that upswing. You know, they've picked number two overall two previous years before this in the draft, and it's been fifth this year, which means they had the fifth worst record last year. If things hold out, they'll be somewhere in the 10 to 11 range, and that's kind of what they were hoping to do, is to be better on the field, and that is a very big possibility for the final tally this season.
Thanks so much for talking with me, C. Trent. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Marianne. Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking about the Reds. My guest was senior baseball writer at The Athletic, C. Trent Rosecrans. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Today's technical director was Josh Elstro. Our intern is Layla Shakui. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Dan Hurley.